Hello, you are tuned into Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Musqueam people at UBC. My name is Alirad Ameri, and I'm joined by my co-host today, Gurman Gill. Each week on Research Review, we interview a researcher who is affiliated with the UBC community and discuss some of their latest work and findings and how they relate to broader issues in society. We would like to welcome Dr. Richard Cavell to Research Review today. Dr. Cavell is a professor at UBC's Department of English and is the co-founder of UBC's Bachelor of Media Studies program. So, Gurman, do you want to start us off a bit?
Yeah, it's a pleasure having you on the show today.
It's a pleasure finally getting going.
Yeah, for sure. Could you tell us a bit about yourself and what got you interested in media studies?
Yeah, what really got me interested in media studies is that when I was doing my doctorate at the University of Toronto in comparative literature, I had the very good fortune to meet Marshall McLuhan. And that was a life-changing meeting. And although I had no intention at all of becoming a media theorist, McLuhan was the sort of person who, once you met him, you sort of couldn't get him out of your head. And as a result, he's been in my head for the last several decades.
Yeah, could you tell us a bit about McLuhan? A lot of his work has shown up in your work as well, I believe.
Well, McLuhan, as you know, is the founder of media studies, and he founded it with a very legendary statement that the medium is the message. But what will be of interest to your listeners is that he made that comment for the first time ever in 1957 at UBC. Okay, so actually the era of media studies begins on the UBC campus in what is now the Barber Library, but was then the main library. And he was at a conference, and he was asked to explain media. And he said, well, the medium is the message. There you go.
Yeah. I guess then...
It's a famous quote, I guess, like the medium is the message. Did he invent that quote?
Yeah, of course. He invented
everything. I've heard that before, yeah.
He was one of the most original persons you could ever meet. McLuhan did not speak in cliches. He invented cliches, but he didn't speak in them.
So I guess you didn't really know media studies was a field until you met McLuhan then.
No, and this is true of academia generally. I mean, media studies began really as communication studies, but media studies is quite different from communication studies. Communication studies is largely a sender-receiver model. That's what's happening right now. I'm sending and you're receiving. But media studies is a recursive model. It's cybernetic. It goes in circles, which means that everything we're saying is becoming part of a sort of media environment, and each additional thing we say becomes packaged into the original statement, okay? So media work in quite a different way. They work environmentally rather than simply in a sort of linear sender-receiver pattern.
Well, so, you know, we could say, like, right now we're basically in the process of creating media in a sort of way, right? This conversation we're having.
Yes, but McLuhan was a very radical thinker, and so he said also media are creating us.
Okay. Yeah, I remember like reading somewhere that he referred to like he worked a lot on like electronic media, and he described it as an extension of our central nervous system. And I was trying to like just internalize that thought and try to think about what it meant.
Well, what it means is Facebook, right? I mean, with Facebook, we basically extended our consciousness outside ourselves, but we've gone even further. We've extended ourselves outside ourselves. We've exchanged the cell for a selfie, right? We don't have selves any longer. We have selfies, okay? Little electronic blips that are outside of us, and that's us.
Yeah.
You know, one just question I have is, it's interesting because what you're describing about McLuhan is in relation to media and, you know, how we're thinking about how it relates to what's going on today, like social media. But I see here, you know, McLuhan, he was born in 1911 and he passed away in 1980, which is more than 40 years ago. But it's also interesting to see how a lot of what you're attributing to him, it's really become more evident nowadays in modern society. Perhaps like back then, it would have been pretty revolutionary to bring these ideas forward.
It was revolutionary. No one understood him. They thought he was insane. They called him a charlatan. His colleagues at the University of Toronto wouldn't speak to him. They'd run in the opposite direction when they saw them coming down the hallway. But you may have seen the Google Doodle about 3 or 4 years ago, where it was stated very clearly. He predicted the internet half a century before the internet. And that Google Doodle, I have a website called Spectres of McLuhan, okay? And I've reproduced, it got international attention. I mean, literally around the world. Basically, every major language picked this up. And they said, yes, I mean, this is just amazing stuff. How did he do it 50 years before the internet? And Marshall once said to me, I'm not a prophet. I simply predict the present. And what he meant by that is people ignore what's around them. Okay. But he saw all of this coming. As soon as he saw the telephone, basically, that could be wired to a fax machine, he knew this was the internet.
Okay. Yeah.
You were probably born after fax machines disappeared from the face of the earth. But, you know, Marshall loved interacting with other people. And he bought the first fax machine in the city of Toronto. But what he discovered to his dismay was he owned the only fax machine, one of the only fax machines in Canada. So he had no one to communicate with. And this obsessed him until he learned that there were many, many fax machines in Japan. And so he bought a Tokyo telephone book and started faxing randomly. It made him very, very happy.
Yeah, it seems to me that McLuhan has lots of interesting thoughts on technology. Do you think he'd be happy with the way it's evolved into like social media?
No.
Could you elaborate a bit on that? Yeah.
He would be appalled. Okay, absolutely appalled. And not that he was particularly enamored of print culture, of literate culture, because he saw there were a lot of problems that literate culture produced. I mean, we are at universities. Universities are the last gasp of literate culture. And indeed, the university was forced to abandon literate culture very, very quickly during COVID, right? We were told to go online at 4:30 p.m. On a Friday afternoon, and Monday, everyone was up online, okay? So this happened very, very quickly because, in fact, it was already happening. It was already there. But Marshall said that we would lose many, many of the values of literate culture as we moved into electronic culture. But what disturbed him most was that we would enter into a world of what is now called the hive mind. Everyone sort of thinking alike. We would lose the power to think in an individual way. And that absolutely appalled him.
You know, that's
right. Yeah.
It's pretty captivating. When you think about it, like, you know, Gurman, like you think about social media these days, like Facebook, TikTok, how it's basically just got people like drones staring at screens.
McLuhan mentioned something about like the electronic retribalization of the West, and that's exactly what's happening. Just like everyone in their little bubbles, not willing to really go out and learn other people's perspectives. Yeah. And that's really what Facebook does for you. It pretty much, with its algorithm, it just forces you to like see only stuff that you interact with, and never really like forces you to look outside your bubble if you don't want to.
You know, one thing just on the topic of Facebook, because, you know, I think everyone has the news that recently Facebook, the parent company, has been renamed Meta, M-E-T-A, in reference to the supposed metaverse. And they basically want to do something with that. I'm not sure, too sure what it is, but what are your thoughts on that, Dr. Cavell, like, especially in relation to the work of McLuhan?
It's simply rebranding. I mean, Facebook is in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
Lawsuits are left, right, and center. So poor old Mark thought he could avoid all of this by giving his company the Hebrew word for death. That, first of all, shows that he does not read very widely. But the metaverse, we already live in the metaverse. We're already in it. I mean, the metaverse is supposed to be a way to encounter your friends on some sort of virtual platform. It's already virtual. What we're doing right now is virtual. I mean, you think you're looking at me and I think I'm looking at you. I'm not looking at you and you're not looking at me. Our machines are doing the looking and the talking. We're already in the metaverse. We've been in the metaverse for half a century. You know, so Zuckerberg's trying to catch up. You know, people are leaving Facebook in droves, okay, in absolute droves. They're going to things like TikTok, etc. So, I mean, he's in deep trouble. He's not going to get out of it this way. You know, I wish he could realize that we already live virtually.
Yeah, to me, it sounds like a way to get more of our metadata.
Right.
That's what they're alluding to.
Great, we'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message. But before we head off, I just wanted to take a chance to talk to everyone, all our listeners today, about Fundrive. Now, what is Fundrive? Fundrive will be kicking off tomorrow, February 3rd, 2022, and it will be going on until February 10th. Fundrive is CITR's annual fundraising program, and we ask that our listeners to go to citr.ca/donate to donate however much you want to help keep CITR on the air, help support the amazing programs that you listen to, such as Research Review. Again, that link is citr.ca/donate.
A Tribe Called Red is the Hallucination with their new record, One More Saturday Night, featuring Javier Mighty, Tanya Tagak, and more, out now.
You are listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Alirat, and along with my co-host Gurman, today we are interviewing Dr. Richard Cavell. So far, we've talked a bit about Marshall McLuhan and how he helped start the field of media studies, also about what exactly the field of media studies is, and a bit about the role which Facebook and the upcoming so-called metaverse plays in the world of media. So Gurman, you had a question.
Yeah, even if we do drive away from Facebook, though, I feel like pretty much every other social media company is trying to do the same thing, even outside of Facebook's like metaverse. Like TikTok has something similar, and then Trump is trying to start his own social media company. And like, it's just really, it only furthers the retribalization. It doesn't really help it at all.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yes. And the big, someone used the word data a moment ago. That's really what they're looking for. Okay. Data is now monetized. Data is the new money. I mean, Bitcoin is a sort of shadow of that. Bitcoin's irrelevant. The real money today is data. Your money is, in fact, data. Okay. Your money is data. There's really no money any longer. That's why we have this huge gap between Main Street and Wall Street. Main Street is still using money, okay? Wall Street's using data. And of course, that's why you can have two diametrically opposed economic systems working at the same time, okay? Hundreds of thousands, millions of people out of work, many, many businesses closing. Just look around Vancouver. And yet Wall Street is going bonkers, you know, though the stocks are just exploding, okay? It's because those stocks have nothing to do with money. They have nothing to do with Main Street. They're pure data. It's data.
It's like, you know, the role of, I guess, algorithms that are coming into play. I guess this is something that we didn't really have a few decades ago. Mm-hmm. And that's something that it's, things are really entering more of an abstract sense, I feel.
That's right. You're absolutely right. Yes. We're entering into a purely abstract existence. And I mean, ultimately, as McLuhan himself said half a century ago, we've reached the point where the last horizon is to simply upload our consciousness into our computers. And of course, people like Peter Thiel, who founded PayPal, who's a multi-billionaire, is pouring billions of dollars precisely into what is called the singularity, the uploading of human consciousness into our devices. Okay.
Yeah, that's pretty much the ultimate extension of our central nervous systems, just to do away with it altogether, just put it into a computer.
That's right. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A lot of your, you have a lot of major books and articles on Marshall McLuhan. Could you maybe go into what some of your major like book publications are?
Well, my first book on McLuhan was called McLuhan in Space. And the reason I called it that is because I had the very clear sense that what McLuhan was really trying to set up was a spatial theory of media, how they actually, media change our notion of space, of where we are. The most dramatic example of that is his concept of the global village, okay, which is deeply misunderstood. If you look global village up in the Oxford English Dictionary, yes, they credit McLuhan for coining the term, and they say he thought of the global village as being some sort of utopia that would be brought to us by electronic media. And his reply to this was, clearly these people have never lived in a village. he said, basically, everybody knows what everyone else is doing. There's really no sense of freedom. There's no sense that you can somehow escape the surveillance of other people's eyes. He said the global village is a horrible place. But in terms of spatial theory, what he was setting up is a local global dynamic, okay? So that if something happens locally in electronic media, it is immediately global. And if something happens globally, it is immediately local. Okay. So our very sense of space was going to be radically changed by electronic media. And of course, it has been changed by electronic media. You know, an event that is happening in London, England right now can have tremendous ramifications here in Vancouver within an hour because of media interconnectivity.
Yeah, for sure. I can just imagine how it's changed over the past few hundred years. Like, even our, like, the first thought I had was, like, our electoral system was, like, designed for this old-fashioned idea of just, like, what happens on the other side of the country doesn't really affect us. So we all needed to just, like, do local elections and just come together and figure out what's happening and then go back to our own provinces and figure out and tell them what's happening. Right. Whereas these days it's sort of just like, well, you can just turn on your TV and see what the election was saying.
You know, it's funny, like you mentioned the electoral example. She mentioned that a while ago, a few months ago, the federal election that was going on just this September. So I was working as a central poll supervisor at one of the polling sites here. And our job was that when the polls close in British Columbia at 7 o'clock, so they're open from 7 p.m. on general election day at 7 o'clock, we basically crack open the ballot boxes and we start counting the votes. And process takes a while because, you know, we have to make sure everything's counted right, things go in the envelope. And the funny thing is, before we finish the count and at the end of the count, my job would be to call our local's election office, tell them, no, like this party got this many votes, this party got that many votes, like this box and all that. Before we finished doing the count, I got a notification on my phone that said, you know, CBC News predicts so-and-so, so was liberal minority government based upon like results from Eastern Canada. And we hadn't even finished counting votes.
Yeah.
And something like that wouldn't have happened 30 years ago. Or even, maybe even like, 20 years ago, that sort of information.
I mean, very soon, probably, you know, voting will be electronic. It will be, the results will be known instantly. I mean, McLuhan said, with television, your living room becomes the voting booth. Meant by that, that politics is going to become more and more, you know, part of our daily lives because we're seeing it all on television. I mean, you know, the Vietnam War in the 1960s, this is the first war fought in people's living rooms. You know, he was absolutely right. I mean, in those days, you had mass media. This is before smartphones, where you could access media at any time. I mean, in the 1950s and 1960s, I think up really until around the 1980s, you know, people would watch the news either at 6 p.m. or at 10 p.m. You'd all be hovered around the television set, you know, and watching the news. And of course, what you were watching in during the Vietnam War was the Vietnam War. That's all changed now, but that's what he meant when he said, you know, the voting booth politics have entered into our living rooms. Yeah. So there's no escape from it. This is the other thing about, you know, the new media, electronic media. It's impossible to escape from it. Mm-hmm. I was reading an article about a massive radio telescope in West Virginia, United States. And it's so sensitive that they ban any sort of Wi-Fi, any sort of electronic media. It's impossible.
Is that this? Yeah, I've heard about this before. There's some sort of like exclusion zone.
That's right.
Like FCC sort of thing over there. And I've heard a lot of people, like conspiracy theorist types, they move there. They think, you know, there's like no radiation that's going to harm your brain or something.
and instead it's filled with it. They actually have military officers going around to try to detect these things. But in the era of the so-called Internet of Things, even your fridge is sending out messages. Mm-hmm. You know, your fridge can email you to say, oh, don't forget to buy milk. You're low on milk. Okay. I mean, we live in a totally mediated environment. Totally mediated. And these people in West Virginia, it's impossible to get away from it. Even an electric blanket is sending out messages. Everything sends out data today. Everything. Because data is money.
It's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I can definitely see how technology can drive further politicization of things. Like, just going back to, like, social media, where, like, Facebook's trying to encourage controversy and politicization of pretty much everything, because that's what drives up viewership and just responsiveness to things. So it's where the money is eventually.
You know, I feel like, you know, back in the old days, for example, and I say old days, maybe like just 20, 30 years ago, you know, everyone in, say, you know, Vancouver, they would read the same newspaper. They would watch the same TV program. It's, you know, everyone's being exposed to the same media. But nowadays with social media online, especially with the whole like algorithm concept of things, everything's just being tailored to each specific individual. And it's designed, you know, in some ways it's designed to like psychologically manipulate people, in fact, yeah. Which is a bit scary.
It's quite sinister and scary. The Harvard professor Shoshana Zuboff, Z-U-B-O-F-F, has written a book called Surveillance Capitalism. It's absolutely brilliant. And what she reveals about Facebook is staggeringly disturbing. It's not simply disturbing, it's deeply disturbing. This is long before the whistleblower, okay? Mm-hmm. Zuboff, she's now retired from Harvard. She's a professor emerita of business. And she just did a lot of on-the-ground research. And the things she discovered about the algorithm and its deployment, how Facebook uses it, it's terrifying. And that won't change with Meta. Meta won't change.
Meta it's going to get worse.
There's a facade over this, okay?
Yeah.
We'll be right back here on CITR to research a view after one short message. But just before we head off, another reminder that Fund Drive will be kicking off tomorrow. So just head on down to citr.ca/donate. That is citr.ca/donate to get your donations in.
Looking to get a reliable and affordable used bike? Need a repair or service to your current ride?
Come to the Bike Kitchen, UBC's full-service community bike shop, located in room 36 of the UBC Life building. Our hours are Monday to Friday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m.
If you buy a bike from us, bring it back when you're done using it, and we'll give you half of your money back, as long as you took care of it. If it needs repairs, we'll split the cost with you.
Yep, you heard us right. We'll give you crisp dollar bills for half the original price of any used bike that you buy from us. minus the cost of repairs.
For more information about our buyback policy and to stay up to date on any COVID-19 inspired changes, find us online at thebikekitchen.com.
You're listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. We are back here, and today we are interviewing Dr. Richard Cavell, a professor at UBC's Department of English and co-founder of UBC's Bachelor of Media Studies program. So in the past bit, we've talked a bit about the basically how media has been in the past, in the recent past, how it's changing, how it's evolving. So going on, Gurman, well, what thoughts do you add on this?
What were some of the other publications you wrote after McLuhan in Space?
Recently I wrote a book called Remediating McLuhan. That largely simply put together my more recent publications all together in one book. But I added a section there. The publisher told me it was a great book, but it was too short. So they wanted me to add about 30 or 40 pages. So I wrote a second part to the book called The Tragedy of Media. And what I found interesting was that the two major media theorists of the 20th century, Marshall McLuhan and the late German media theorist Friedrich Kittler, K-I-T-T-L-E-R, both understood media as tragic. And so I wanted to really explore this idea and find out why are these two great media theorists arguing that media is tragic. And I came to the conclusion that they do so because media largely take us out of ourselves. They represent a sort of death of the self to a certain degree, a loss of the self, because of course electronic media put us in these immense tribal groups, to use your word, where the sense of self dissipates and becomes lost.
It's interesting how media tries to give this whole like facade of personalization where they say everything's tailored to you, the person, when in reality they're just like trying to clump you into a group.
That's right. Yes, precisely. That's it.
So I also noticed that there was a mention of like McLuhan's work in relation to advances in physics and artistic experimentation. Could you maybe elaborate a bit on that and what that means?
Well, McLuhan had an immense influence on the art world, immense. And my friend Alex Kitnick, K-I-T-N-I-C-K, has just published a book with University of Chicago Press called Distant Early Warning, where he argues that basically McLuhan transformed the avant-garde, which, of course, the avant-garde began before electronic media were truly established, but he transformed it insofar as he encouraged artists to make electronic media part of their art practice. It's a very, very good book and very convincing, and I think Kitnick is quite right. I mean, everyone from John Cage to Nam June Paik to a raft of Canadian artists, American artists like Robert Rauschenberg, major artists of the 20th century, have already acknowledged their debt to McLuhan. So an immense influence on the art world that has not disappeared. It's still ongoing.
That's great. So, you know, moving on to like sort of another topic of yours, specifically related to media studies, I want to talk a bit about the Bachelor of Media Studies program, which I understand you were one of the founders involved in that. And just something I wanted to like preface before going forward, that you know, I took a little look at this, and I've heard about this program before, but to be honest, I've never really met anyone in it, because I understand it's a fairly like small and competitive program to get into, right?
That's right. Yeah.
And it's the interesting thing that, you know, that struck me is that most other majors at UBC, you know, it's fairly concentrated in a specific area. So, you know, the biology students taking biology courses, the political science students taking poli-sci courses. But the media studies program, which is part of the Faculty of Arts, it features courses from a variety of disciplines. Like there's creative writing, visual arts, film studies, computer science, geography, you know, like statistics, like you can basically take anything. So how do you, like, it's pretty interesting. Like, how did these like different disciplines come together to form this program?
With great difficulty. It took a long time to convince colleagues, the dean, etc., the university, that media was a viable area of study. You know, I mean, this has been an ongoing battle. Media for a long time were considered, it was considered to be like studying television and radio and movies. Okay. We've reached the point now, I don't think it takes any effort to convince anyone that media are everywhere and indeed media are part of us. Okay. So with this, there's been a greater acceptance of the importance of the study of media. I mean, media studies span the entire university, okay? From law to arts to medicine. You mentioned geography. A colleague in the forestry faculty has come up with the idea of the Wood Wide Web. Not the World Wide Web, but the Wood Wide Web, because she's put forward an understanding that trees now actually communicate with their rhizomes underground, that they communicate and exist in a sort of mediated platform. Mm-hmm. Now, I think she's absolutely right, but you notice that this is happening, that she's putting forward this idea right now, because of course, media, digital media and the internet have become the dominant medium. And so with any dominant medium, you think through it, okay? So it changes your world perspective. And so I'm actually not surprised at all that she's come up with this theory at this particular moment. But media are everywhere. Our program is interdisciplinary. It is a boutique program. We admit around 40 people a year. Oh, wow. And we admit them at about 10% higher than the average for UBC admissions, okay? Because it is so contemporary. We get hundreds of applications every year.
So it's probably harder to get into than med school.
Well, by that measure, it's difficult for an undergraduate program in the Faculty of Arts. The students are very, very good. I love the students. They're extremely good. They're a pleasure to teach. I'm hoping in the future we can get something established at the graduate level. That's my next goal.
It's cool. Yeah, it's definitely an interesting program now that you take a look at it. It's like something I did not hear about when I was applying for UBC as an undergraduate. And if I did know about it, I probably would have considered applying for it after this conversation, especially. It seems pretty interesting. I'm a big fan of like interdisciplinary studies, and it seems like a very, very cool program. Like, you know, what type of students would you say the media studies program is like best suited for?
That's really hard to say. I mean, it's very much an international cohort that we attract. Very much international. I have students from around the world in this class. I mean, that's not unusual for UBC, but I think it's especially so true for the Bachelor of Media Studies program. I mean, some have an interest in media. They like studying film. Okay, so for them, that's what media is. And that was certainly true we started about 7 or 8 years ago. That was very, very true. People thought media meant I'm going to get a job working for Netflix. Mm-hmm. Well, they might, but what we try to set up is a much more theoretical program, okay? And that's why they also have computer science. The first Faculty of Arts program in history of the university to require computer science, okay? We did this because, of course, by the time those students graduate after 4 years, the entire media landscape will have changed. Mm-hmm. That's how rapidly media are changing. And so if we give them a theoretical component after those 4 years, they will land on their feet. Otherwise, we will have taught them something that's already out of date, you know.
It's true.
We'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message. Again, just before we head off, wanted to remind you that Fun Drive is kicking off tomorrow. That is tomorrow, February 3rd, 2022, and it will be going on until February 10th. Now you may be wondering, what is Fun Drive? Fun Drive is CITR's annual fundraising program. So if you want to contribute to CITR, just head on down to citr.ca/donate. That's citr.ca/donate.
Metal Radio, bringing you the best metal for over 30 years on CITR. Tune in every Saturday from 1 to 3.
You are listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. We're back, and today here we are interviewing Dr. Richard Cavell, co-founder of UBC's Bachelor of Media Studies program. In the past bit, of course, we've talked a bit about Marshall McLuhan again, and also touched upon the actual media studies program at UBC, how this program works, the students which are part of this program. So
what type of fields, what type of work or like postgraduate studies have you seen like Bachelor of Media Studies students go on to do?
Well, you know, one of our great problems with the BMS students is they do arts co-op. You know, so they do co-op in their third year, and the employer will say to them at the end of 2 months, oh, please don't go back to university. We want to hire you immediately. we have a bit of difficulty actually keeping our students, but I really want to stress how important arts co-op is for the entire arts faculty. I mean, it's just the most wonderful program founded by my former student, Julie Walkley. So we do have a bit of trouble, but I mean, these students, I'll give you one example, okay? You may know on campus, we have something called UBC Studios. Have you heard mm-hmm. of that?
Yeah.
So it's really a brilliant facility so that if, say, if I, as a prof, especially during COVID, wanted to record lectures, I could go over there. They have a wonderful room. You basically stand in front of the camera, press a button, and everything sort of works together, and it looks really professional. So they were looking for someone to work there as a sort of executive assistant. And they put out a general ad. Anyone could apply, though it was largely directed towards graduate students. One of our BMS undergraduates got the job. So that shows you how competitive they are. Okay. But I mean, you can basically walk into whatever you want now. And, you know, a lot of these students also, they're thinking in terms of startups. I mean, one day it was, I'll never forget this day. One of my BMS students put up her hand. She said, in the middle of a lecture, she put up her hand. She says, Professor Cavell, are we ever going to get a job? I said, no, you're going to invent the jobs. That's what they're doing.
Wow.
Okay. When I met with the director of Microsoft here in Vancouver, I had a couple meetings with Eduardo and, I explained to him the program. He said, these are the people we want. He called them cultural entrepreneurs or cultural technologists, people who can work both in culture, within cultural concepts, and within technological concepts, because he said, that's where we're going today. Okay. I mean, culture is becoming technological, right?
Yeah. It's like the intersection between, you know, technology and society. It's becoming more intertwined every day.
Yes, precisely. Yes.
Oh, thank you. This is it's a very interesting program now that I think about it. It's too bad that I've already graduated very recently.
Yeah, what I find particularly interesting is just with the small exclusive programs, I find that it's the exact opposite, where there's just a very focused like curriculum. For example, I'm in a program called CAPS. It's a physiology program, accepts about like 20 to 30 people each year. And every course I'm taking this year has the name CAPS in front of it. I don't take anything else. That's just what I do now.
Yeah.
It's the exact opposite of pretty much what BMS is.
Yeah. I don't think specialists can survive in the era of computation, of digitality, and of the internet. McLuhan has a wonderful sentence in his book, The Medium is the Massage. Not message, the medium is massage. He loved changing. He loved quoting himself and changing things. He called his book in 1967, The Medium is the Massage, because he said, the media are, first of all, the mass age, but also media work you over. And third of all, media are digital, which means they're tactile. Right? These are digits. Okay. So he was already looking forward to the digital era half a century ago. And in that book, he has one really wonderful sentence, which goes like this. Come into my parlor, said the computer to the specialist. You may know that line. People used to say, come into my web, said the spider to the fly. McLuhan changes it to say, come into my parlor, said the computer to the specialist. He said, it's impossible to be a specialist in the era of electronic media, because we all have to be multitaskers in the era of multimedia. Now, you mentioned, German, the medical profession. I'm sure you know about telemedicine. Telemedicine is taking over. I mean, we have a crisis in medicine at the moment for all sorts of reasons. Doctors are dropping out of the medical profession post-COVID, especially the National Health Service in England, just leaving the profession in droves. And it's also very, very difficult, like in Canada, to get what used to be called a family doctor. And people are turning to telemedicine. I mean, TELUS in British Columbia has a massive telemedicine program. And so what is happening? People are interfacing either with a doctor or with a computer, right? So, I mean, there's a very good example of how even the medical profession, I mean, the medical profession also uses electronic cadavers to teach anatomy, right? My dentist, who's also a professor at UBC, uses an electronic model of the head to teach his students dentistry. And he said, you know, Richard, the big problem is I've got to teach them to look back at the patient. Don't just look at the electronic model, okay? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure. There's definitely this, telemedicine does help with a lot of things, but it misses that sort of like face-to-face interaction, which a lot of medicine really benefits from.
Yeah.
There's a lot like a physician can get from a patient just from like looking at them face-to-face.
Yes. Yes. And yet, you know, I think we've gone beyond face-to-face. I think face-to-face is probably long over. You know, I was invited to Budapest to the Hungarian Academy of the Sciences a few years ago by the internet company. I don't think it's here all that much. It's an internet company that you find in Europe rather than North America. And they called a whole bunch of media theorists in because they wanted to sort of understand what would be the next phase in media. The reason they had this conference in Budapest is that Hungary had the most rapid penetration of electronic media of any nation ever. So they went from basically nothing to 94% in about a year and a half. It was simply astonishing. And this was a big problem, of course, for the media company, because where are you going to go after that? What's next? And so we sort of went around the table and they were asking each of us to suggest what might be the next phase. I said, well, the next phase will be medicine. And they said, yes, we're already were already experimenting with putting, wireless transmitters in dogs. And that, I think, German, will be the next phase of face-to-face. So it's still sort of embodied, but it's embodied media, okay? So it will be my data being sent to my doctor, but just as what we're doing right now, it will be data being sent and data being sent back. It may appear to be face-to-face, but it will actually be computer-to-computer.
Yeah, I mean, that's already happening. I know some cardiologists, they'll just give their patients an app or something, and they'll just record their data, and they'll just get sent off to the cardiologist, and they'll just, do everything that way. They don't even need an appointment at that point.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you could put a sensor in my body. So let us say I have an irregular heartbeat. Put a sensor in my body. If things get too irregular, I will send a message to the doctor. The doctor will send a message to me, Richard, increase your prescription, right? Or in some cases, the doctor can actually change your heartbeat from the doctor's office, okay? This is where we are now. Now, does this mean we're robots?
We're getting closer.
Hopefully not.
Yeah, we're sort of nearing the end of the episode. I just have one last question. It seemed like you got to spend a lot of time with Marshall McLuhan. What was that experience like, and what was the main takeaway you got from that time?
The main takeaway was that a number of takeaways. I mean, McLuhan loved talking. He did most of the talking, okay? He loved an audience. He just loved talking. And this was very, very interesting because he also predicted that electronic media would take us back to a sort of oral culture, okay? Like the chats on Zoom, okay? The other thing about McLuhan was, I've had the good fortune to meet and work with several very smart people, people who I would call geniuses in my lifetime, the greatest of them.
It seems like
McLuhan operated to remove a tumor from his brain. And it was at that point the longest operation in American medical history. He's a visiting professor in New York that year. And when McLuhan recovered, the doctor said to him, well, Marshall, the operation was more or less a success, but there's one negative thing I have to tell you about. And McLuhan said, and what's that? He said, well, you've lost about a third to a half of your memory. And McLuhan said, oh, that's wonderful. The doctor says, what do you mean that's wonderful? He said, now I can reread my books. He had a very strange sense of humor. The very first time I met him, we sat down at the table and he turned to me and he said, what happens to a duck when it flies upside down? And I said, I'm terribly sorry, Professor McLuhan, I don't know. He said, it quacks up. That was McLuhan, one of the great geniuses, perhaps the greatest Canadian genius, and someone who has transformed our lives doing what he said he always did, predicting the present. It's great speaking with you both. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And definitely. I'd love to know when this is going to be aired.
Yeah, we'll let you know. Yeah, it's probably sometime in January, I think. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
Wednesdays at 6 o'clock.
Yes, Wednesdays at 6. Good.
Yes.
I did my first CRTR program in 1980.
Oh, wow. That's... How many times have you been on CITR before?
This was a two-part program on Glenn Gould, the great Canadian pianist who was a friend of McLuhan's, deeply influenced by McLuhan. Then I did another one at the year we were founding the BMS program. I get another one in order to get student interest.
Oh, wow.
So, and that was maybe about 8 or 9 years ago. So that's largely what I've done for CITR, not a lot, but I really loved the show in 1980. It was called Reading Glenn Gould because they had just published all of Gould's essays. Gould loved writing essays. And so it was a program about this book called The Glenn Gould Reader.
But yeah, thanks again for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This concludes the research review on CITR 101.9 FM. Again, my name is Alirod, and my co-host today was Gurman Gill. And today we interviewed Dr. Richard Cavell, a professor at UBC's Department of English and co-founder of UBC's Bachelor of Media Studies program. One last reminder before we head off again today is that tomorrow, February 3rd, 2022, will be the start of Fundrive, CITR's annual fundraising program. So be sure to head on down to citr.ca/donate and get a donation, whatever you feel like in. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you here on Research Review in 2 weeks.